Welcome everybody to our October 2016 Story Lab call with the Storytelling and Organization Group. This is Tom Sparrow hosting tonight, and our special guest tonight is Tom Sparrow. And Tom, welcome. Thank you, Tom. And our topic tonight is managing the dead, ghost stories to keep your organization alive. And before I share a story, I'd like to just share with everyone how I kind of came to this point to create these stories and to offer them to organizations. And I think, Dave, you know, Dave and Peter on the line, I know Geraldine, Corey, maybe you know Cora, but my work has been more as a juggler than as a storyteller in the last 30 years as a professional entertainer. But there's kind of two basic types of jugglers. There's those who juggle to music and those who talk while they juggle. And I've always been a person who talked while I juggled, even though occasionally I do some musical pieces. But my very first piece that I created as a juggler, I called The Origins of Juggling, and I created this story about how juggling began. So right from the beginning, storytelling and juggling for me were connected. And after I had been a professional juggler for about 5-6 years, I noticed that people were calling me up and wanting to hire me, not just because they wanted entertainment, but because they wanted the analogy of juggling. And I had several people mention, like the old guy on the Ed Sullivan Show who had all the plates going, and he'd be running from one plate to the next plate to the next plate, trying to keep them all in motion. And then they said, you know, do you do anything like that? Because our people are jugglers, and we want to show them what a juggler actually is and then draw some connections to their work. And after I started noticing that there was a market for that, I focused much of my attention on it. And then I became like an analogist, doing juggling shows for not just entertainment, but for the analogy of what they brought to people. And people would look at the juggling show, and just with a little bit of frame of reference, they'd say, you know, I cannot believe how accurately you portrayed us. It's like you are one of us. Usually I would be doing the same moves, but I would just nuance it a little bit, and I would work in a little bit of their language, and it really spoke to people. But because that was the primary reason why people were bringing me in rather than they just wanted a juggler, I started looking at expanding that connection, and that led me into the world of organizational storytelling to try to, in a similar way, share some stories that I thought represented their life, but it wasn't really their story because it wasn't the story about their business. It was some imaginary story, or it was one of my personal stories that they could relate to and think about it for themselves. And then one day, after I had been involved in our organization, the Storytelling and Organization Group, for a while, I thought, you know, what do I have that I'm interested in that I could bring to our field? And I thought, well, I've always loved ghost stories, and I haven't really heard anybody talk about ghost stories in terms of organization. Although sometimes people talk about what killed an organization. And tonight on the call with us is Dave Brower, and Dave has been doing some ghost stories as well. So I'm really glad to have your voice in here, Dave. And when I offer the ghost stories. The reason for it is not because I want to scare people or creep people out, but I'm looking for a vehicle to promote engaging conversation that might help people to reflect on their own behaviors, their own opportunities, and sometimes think system-wide, do some system thinking about what's in place that could be changed. And the ghost story is that vehicle to help them generate those thoughts and ideas. So I'll just take a quick pause right now and see if anybody has any questions before we go forward. Any questions or comments? Okay, well then, if you haven't already, go ahead and mute your phone if you do *6 for the purposes of this call, then you'd be muted rather than, you know, or you could just do it however your phone does it. But I'm hoping to share two stories with you tonight, and we'll share the first one, talk a little bit, and then go on to the next one. And this first story is called Right Here. There was a woman named Shanika who worked for Job and Family Services for the county. And Shanika had been there now for about 3 years, and she had a problem. And her problem was that she cared too much. And after you have about 1,000 people who go through your line and come up to you, you start to recognize the people who are truly desperate. And once Shanika got to that spot, she had a sense that she just had to do everything she could to help these people. And so she spent extra time with them. And because of that, her manager called her in and said, "Your numbers are low, and you have to increase the number of people that you see in a day. You just have to speed up your work." And it was after she had gotten that talk that she found herself in the break room by herself. And next to the vending machine was a photo of a woman named Miss Mabel Ann Rutherford. And Miss Mabel Ann was deceased now, but she had worked for the county for almost 40 years, and 7 times she was awarded the Employee of the Year. And Shanika was just looking at that picture, and she said, in that empty room, she said, "Miss Mabel, how do you do it? How do you see all the people and still care?" And she thought she heard a little voice that said, "You do what you can." And Shanika said, as she put her hand on her brow and rubbed it, "I just don't understand how." And the lights flickered. And then Shanika thought she smelled a faint baby powder scent in the air. And her eyes misted up. And standing next to the vending machine came a figure walking toward her now who said, "Dear Shanika, I mean to say that sometimes you just put your hand just for an instant on one of our clients' hands, just to let them know that it's going to be all right, that you care about them. Sometimes you look them in the eye till you know that they know you see them. You really see them. And sometimes it means you just write out a phone number on a sheet of paper and hand it to them, even though you already have a pre-printed sheet with that same phone number on it, because now they know that you've given them the number. There really isn't a rule of what to do. You just do what you can. And after that moment, after that encounter, Shanika felt that Miss Mabel was always with her. And one day, about a week after this episode, she was looking at this person who was standing in front of her and telling her a story that she was having trouble believing, but she wasn't sure, and so she just kind of whispered, "Miss Mabel, what do you think?" And Miss Mabel had said, "He's as slithery as a snake. Do not trust him." And so she didn't. And about a week after that, Shanika looked out and she saw Miss Mabel was in her line, and it was deep. There were lots of people waiting to speak with her, but there was this person standing next to Miss Mabel, and Miss Mabel was holding her up. She was leaning on Miss Mabel, and when that person finally made it up to the counter by her desk, her name was Miss Rodriguez, there wasn't anything Shanika couldn't do for her. And she made sure Miss Rodriguez understood everything and had her paperwork filed exactly right. But that takes time. And her manager called her out again and said, "Other people have to fill in for the slack you create by spending too much time with certain people. You have to move the line along. If I need to tell you again, you will be fired. I can't help it. Your numbers are my numbers. We have to see everyone." And then today happened. Shanika had seen this woman in her line. She was wearing large, dark sunglasses on a cloudy day. And she had a little boy with her, and it took a long time for them to finally make their way through the line, almost an hour before they saw Shanika. And her name was Sheila Baxter, and her son's name was Bradley. And it didn't take but about 20 seconds to determine that she was in the wrong line. And it was Shanika's job to get rid of her as quickly as possible so that she could process the people who were in the right line. But Shanika didn't do her job. She came away from the counter and she said hello to Sheila, and she picked up Bradley and she made Bradley laugh, and she saw behind Sheila's dark glasses, saw the swollen purple skin around her eye. And then she put her arm around Sheila while still holding Bradley and walked her over to the right line, across the county building, up a flight of stairs. But when they got up there to that room, Sheila said she couldn't spend any more time here. She had to go. Her husband would already be furious. And so she left that line, and she carried Bradley down the stairs, and Shanika followed them and saw them go out the door and get into a brown LTD Ford. And off they went. Shanika got back to her station and her manager was waiting for her, and she was furious that she had left her post, and Shanika was fired, but she was ordered to finish her day's work. It was just a moment after that that everyone heard the news that Sheila Baxter's husband hadn't even driven out of the parking lot. He had just pulled over, and he pulled out a gun, and he shot Sheila, and he shot their son, and he shot himself. And now it's the end of the day, and Shanika's just putting her things into her bag, taking them out of her desk, knowing that this is her last time there. But who should be standing right here but Sheila and Bradley? And they say that they've come because they don't know where to go, and she had been so nice to them. And Shanika tries to comfort them, tries to reach out to them, tries to pat Bradley, tries to hug Sheila, but she can't. She can't. And so she says, Miss Mabel, please. Sheila's here, and I don't know where she needs to go, but I know you know. Please, Miss Mabel, help us. And the lights flickered, and that slight scent of baby powder was in the room. And her eyes, Shanika's eyes, misted over, and suddenly she saw Miss Mabel there, and Miss Mabel was hugging Sheila, and she picked up Bradley, and now they're walking up the stairs. They're walking up the grand stairway, and they stop and turn towards Shanika, and Sheila says, thank you for helping. And Bradley waves and says, bye-bye. And now they go up into the light. And Shanika has her things, and she carries her bag down the stairs without a job, not knowing what she's going to do. But she knows she's going to do what she can. And that is our first story for tonight. And I think a great process question after a story like this, and for me, my method of process after sharing a story like this is to break people into pairs or put them into a threesome or possibly into a table discussion, but I find smaller is better because people feel a little bit more free or perhaps compelled to speak. And an easy question to start with is just what strikes you about this story? And people can process that in lots of different ways, and you get all kinds of comments that can come from observations of what they saw or what moved them about the story. Some people will be very literal and say, you know, something like this could never happen. This doesn't exist. And then other people might be on the other end and say, you know, this is actually the truth. You know, I had an experience very similar to this, or my aunt did. So you can get the full gamut there. But that's a way to approach into a conversation. But from my way of thinking, where the perhaps greater value comes is if you ask a question that might be like, what sacrifices have you had to make in your work quality because you had too much to do? You know, have you ever found yourself overworked and just not able to finish your work and what happened in that situation, or what's happening in that situation now. Another question is, what does the phrase, "you do what you can," mean to you? And then you harvest these conversations so people can have these conversations, and then you could do it just as a kind of popcorn style for the large group's benefit, you know, share a little bit about what came out of your conversation. Or you could do it in a more artistic way and have the small group or the pairs draw a picture of some learning or create a few words that represents their story, and share the wisdom in the room, share the sentiments in the room, and get people to talk. So that's my method, and that's my intention for these particular stories that I'm sharing. But it's a brand new project, and I just posted the first one on LinkedIn, and I have an email list where for the next 25 months, if I go according to my plan, I'm going to send one of these stories out each month. And then I'm going to evaluate it after 2 years there. So let's take another pause here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Give you a Tom, I was waiting to learn what Chanika's actual job was, but it was never articulated, but it didn't have to be. Eventually it didn't make any difference.
Yeah. Well, I had her originally, when I wrote this story, Pete, as a person who worked with folks who were unemployed. And she was verifying that they were searching for their job. But as it turns out, then it would be kind of a past year's story, because these days most counties don't have people come in. They do it all online. So you don't have these long unemployment lines like used to be. At least that's what I've been told. So then I thought, you know, do I really need to articulate the job? And it might be helpful, but it also is somewhat problematic, because then if you make it a specific job and then people start thinking, well, this isn't quite right.
That's a good point, because I had it in my mind that she worked for Department of Motor Vehicles.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, it could be that. You know, there are some long lines there. Yeah, I'm not sure, but she had tried to get a job with the Park Service. Which I say just because you're the veteran Park Service guy.
Yeah. Well, I like the way you tied that back, that she didn't know what she was going to do, but she was going to do what she could. I'd like to tie back, because I wasn't sure how this was going to end.
Yeah. Well, part of it for me is people who really care about their work, and I found this in my own work, sometimes you just have so much stuff to do, you just kind of like burn through it. And it's not the quality that I want, but you just have to get it done. And some people have a great difficulty in doing that, and they don't want to compromise themselves. And I think that that's a really valuable discussion to have. You know, can you just race through the numbers? You know, there's lots of social workers out there who have a lot of people to see, and other caseworkers who have to get to everybody. And they don't have a whole lot of time to have a solid connection to really assess what's going on. So I know that it's a live issue for some organizations, and I would bet, you know, almost everybody. But
yeah, well, I don't want to dominate the conversation, but there is an application beyond serving people in a line too. From my own experience, there are folks in the Forest Service that had a terrific passion about wilderness and managing wilderness, but our wilderness budgets always shrunk, and we could never do the job that we thought we needed to do. And folks who joined the organization specifically because of wilderness values were always frustrated. And that idea that, well, there are some things that are beyond our control, we've got to do what we can do. And I think that has application in a lot of service type industries.
Yeah. Thanks, Pete. Yeah, that's a good example of the people who get into the business, you know, into the agency because they really care about the wilderness, and then things just keep getting cut back.
Yep.
I know a bunch of people in parks and recreation in the States, and that's just been trimmed tremendously. It's so hard to offer programs when you have such a limited budget. Dave or Cora, any comments, or Geraldine?
My only comment was your delivery is excellent for that type of story. It's the first time I really heard you tell a story like that before, so I appreciate the feelings behind how you relate that story to people. That makes it as effective as the story itself.
Yeah. I had my phone on mute, so I was asking the question. I was making a statement, but you couldn't hear me.
Oh.
This is
oh.
Cora.
Yes,
like, why aren't they hearing me? Oh, because my phone's on mute. As a faculty member at a college, but I totally agree with this, but I also agree with you wholeheartedly that this probably is related to almost any industry, any job, any situation that is, I mean, I can't imagine anything that everybody probably wants to have more time to do their job. In my case, my students were the most important thing that was in my life as far as my job was concerned. And therefore, I won't say frequently, but regularly got in trouble with the administration because I didn't do all the reporting on time because I was too busy taking care of my students. And mm-hmm. I look at you do what you can do as far as doing the reports. You know, I just did them when I could and the best I could because my priority was my students. And it was hard for anybody to change my mind about that because it truly was the most important thing that I did for my job. And lots of times I would let other parts of my job slack and, you know, be called in for it, be written up for it, whatever. You need to not take so much time. I had a manager actually tell me one time that when I was registering students, I took too much time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, but that's when I get to know them. That's when I'm, you know, meeting them one-on-one and not in a classroom situation. They're in my office and I'm connecting with them. But yeah, I was told that I spent way too much time working with students. How could that be true? So, yes, I mean, the story was beautiful. I just loved it. It was just so, I can see where it would just open up such amazing conversation that you could never do any other way except with a story.
Yes, I think that's why I'm part of this group, is that story is an amazing tool to just open up people on really deep levels. If the stories are told and if the container, the setting for the sharing is conducive to it.
If you went in there and did a PowerPoint presentation about customer service
and then said,
you know, these are the points of customer service and this is what's important.
Yeah.
How do all you feel about customer service? You know, that's just like, it's not going to go to the heart like this will.
Yeah, and I one of the things that I believe very strongly is that the things that are most valuable to people are things that they think of themselves. And when someone like a speaker is saying something that resonates for them, that's good. But if the person actually thinks it and then says, oh, yeah, the speaker's saying that too, then it's even stronger. But if a person doesn't really think it and then they hear it and it makes sense to them, for the most part, that information is just lost.
Right.
So
they got to feel it because they're not feeling it. This will make you feel it.
Feel it, but also feel it. Thinking it for themselves, you know, finding what really matters for them. So if you come up with a series of things of what you do what you can means, and then you give it to them in a PowerPoint, you know, there could be some value in that. People might recognize some opportunities for them. But if the people come up with those ideas themselves, then they own it. And when you own it, it's just more valuable to you. So this is a way to help people think and feel and own some ideas that are important to their work, their organization.
Well, thank you, because that's incredibly valuable. Absolutely. Yes.
You're
very
welcome.
Valuable.
And so I want to tell this second story, and then we'll have just a little bit of time to close. But it's another story that takes almost 10 minutes to tell. So I launch into it. And this one's a little more scary. And it's entitled Down the Stairs. So Melinda was not feeling well today, and it was the last Friday of the month. And on the last Friday of the month, her whole office went out to lunch on the company and had a team lunch. But on this particular day, she wasn't feeling good, and she had brought some soup that she could have for lunch. And so she asked her boss if it would be okay if she just stayed at the office, and he said it would. And then just a couple minutes later, everyone, all 17 of the other employees, were out of the building, and now, for the first time, Melinda was alone in the office. And it was kind of creepy because of the rats. Now, she hadn't seen any rats, but this was a new building for this agency, which was called the Cool Concepts Ad Agency. And at Cool Concepts, they had just taken a six-month option on this place to lease it, but they had the option to buy it after 6 months. And it was a storefront that had two apartments above it and then a basement below it. And it was a really inviting place. They had beanbag chairs and a pool table. They had a little section for a BB gun. They had all kinds of fun things, and they made different types of balloon animals. They had things creatively strewn all over the office. And Melinda was in the kitchen now, and she was wishing that she had worn some leggings today with her dress. Her legs were cold, and so she pulled out the little space heater there in the tiled kitchen area, and she turned it on, and she took her soup, and she put it into the microwave, and she had it now warming up. And a few seconds later, the heater stopped, the microwave stopped, and the lights went dead. And Melinda knew that she had blown a fuse, tripped the circuit, and she knew what that meant. It meant that she's going to have to go downstairs into that old basement. So she walked to the hallway, which was carpeted, and she saw where the trap door was, and she put her hand on that old handle that had been around for 136 years, just as old as the building, and she pulled it up, and she took the flashlight off the bottom of the trap door, and she shined it into the basement. And it was mostly empty, but there were some broken chairs and a wobbly table and a shovel that looked like it had a lot of use from coal. She shined the light down the stairs, and she counted the stairs, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Who builds a basement with 13 stairs? She started down the stairs, and when she got about to the fifth stair, a spider web went right into her face, and she pulled her hand across her face and pulled off those sticky strands of the spider web, and now it was stuck on her hand, and she pushed it on to the banister that went down the basement, and she continued down, and there was a light switch at the end of the stairwell, and she flicked it, but there was nothing going. The place was so dark. How many things could be on one circuit? But she walked across the basement floor, which was muddy from the flooding, and the walls were made of stacked limestone, which meant they weren't smooth at all, and there were lots of crevices where spiders and anything else that wanted to nest in the dark could hide. And she made it across the basement to the room where the electric panel was, and she put her hand onto the doorknob, and it was cold. It shouldn't have been that cold, but it was wet in the same way. And just as she paused, she smelled something rotting. And it immediately took her back to this place behind her parents' house where there was a tree that had gotten cut down. And years after it had been cut down, there was that rotting smell. And she thought, how long does it take for all those massive roots to finally rot away? And she wondered what was rotting in this basement. She opened the door, and she walked into the little room. It was a cold cellar without any windows. It was like a chamber. And she went to the panel where the electric circuits were, but the door closed. So she went back and opened the door, but she could see that it was on a spring, and it just kept shutting. So she went over to the electric panel, and she shined her light looking for the red tab, and she finally found it. It was on number 5, and she pulled it back and then pushed it forward, and now it was black. But just at that second, she dropped, or something hit her flashlight, and it fell to the ground, and she instinctively went down on the ground, and her knees could feel the mush that was in that room, and her hand groped for the flashlight, but she couldn't find it. But then she felt something on her arm. She felt something move on her arm, and she let out a scream, and then she calmed herself. She put her hands next to her face, but she couldn't see them. This room was as dark as a cave. She could see nothing, but she calmed herself. She said, don't imagine things. Just get the flashlight. Just get the flashlight. And she moved her hand across the floor, but then she felt a sting on top of her hand. Her big knuckle was being bitten upon. She pulled her hand up, and she moved it back and forth, but whatever she did, she couldn't shake it loose. She was feeling biting going on her hand and up her arm, and then suddenly onto her cheek. Her cheek, she felt something scratching and tearing or biting, and she fell back into the corner in the cellar, and she let out a scream and then a whimper, and she thought that she was trapped, and there was nothing she could do. But in that moment, something flashed through her mind, which was when she was in Colorado, she remembered at the start of a hiking trail, she had read a sign that said, if attacked by a wild animal, fight back. And then she thought, I have claws too, and she bared her nails, and she began swiping her hands through the air, saying, get away from me. But something was biting her. She could feel it on her neck, and she clawed at her own neck. But she could feel nothing but the pain. But she righted herself, and then she remembered another thing. She thought, Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz had defeated the Wicked Witch with just water, so she began spitting into the air, clawing her fingernails through the air and screaming, get away from me. And she pushed herself forward, forward, and she was at the door now. She fell through the door, picked herself up, ran over to the light post, flipped the switch, and now the basement was filled with light, and she looked around and saw nothing except her hand and her arm were bleeding and gouged, and she put her hand on her face filled with mud and blood, and she went up the steps, 4, 5, 6. Something grabbed her right on her back. She fell down onto the stairs. She was slipping down, 4, 3, 2. She mustered her strength. She spat in the air. She whipped her nails through the air, and she went back onto those stairs, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 12. She was feeling her heel being bitten, so she did a mule kick back. She swiped with her fist. She spit in the air and said, get away, bitch. She made it up the 13th step onto the floor, slammed down the cellar trap door, and she ran to the front, opened up the door. Now she was outside. She was bleeding. She was bloody. She was frantic. But what she thought was very clear. I will strongly recommend to management that we do not take the option to buy this building. And that's the story, Down the Stairs.
I like that.
Any thoughts or comments about that, Pete?
a good, rational, logical ending to that story.
Yeah. I think, you know, once again, you know, you could let people process that. And for some people, a story like that could be really scary. And hard to take, but hopefully it's not quite over the top. It's a little bit gory with a little blood and gouging. But I think it was within the realm of possibilities of not too scary. But yeah, go ahead, Cora.
It was certainly scary, and it was certainly attention. It was certainly kept our attention very powerful. But I also think that this is what I came from. How many things do we allow happen in our companies that we don't strongly recommend to management that we don't do? And it may not be rats in the basement, but there's always something else. There's always things that you know could be better and we all kind of just go, oh, well, that's the way it is. Sometimes I used to find people hanging out in the hallway at work complaining, as people do. And I would joke by saying, how long have you worked here? And then maybe like 3 years. I'm like, oh, you haven't been here long enough to know that that's just the way it is. And I was joking, but sometimes that is how things are, that that's just the way it is. And we don't take the her last statement was, I will strongly recommend to management. It wasn't a, God, we really shouldn't buy this building, but it was, I will strongly recommend that we do not buy this building. So you know that when she went to management, she was going to have power behind what she was saying. It wasn't going to just be a comment.
Yeah.
So that was my take from it, anyway.
Yeah. I think a great question after a story like this, after you just let people say what struck them immediately, you know, is something like, you know, when have you ever been up against a wall, but then found the strength to keep going? And when I wrote the story, I wrote it with that intention of fighting back being the quality that I wanted the story to be most about. Now, it might not be coming through like that for everybody, but I think the question still stands, which is, you know, have you ever found yourself up against the wall, thought maybe that you had no chance, but then somehow found the strength to fight through it or get through it? Or, you know, a similar question in there is, you know, have you had that flash of insight when you think you're done for of what you could do next that could get you through that moment of despair or terror or hardship? So those are some of the stories and some of the techniques. I think of these stories as generative, of trying to help people generate in themselves qualities that are good for any organization to embrace. And certainly that sense of empathizing with others and figuring out, you know, what you can do, you know, what can you do? And then also that fighting quality, that sense of grit that's being written about now is another quality that every organization would like to have in their people. I think, at least in theory. Any more questions or comments?
Well, I found it very interesting to hear the story over the phone in a different kind of format, to not have you visible, which is how I've heard it before. And it was in some ways a little spookier because of the kind of disembodied quality. Plus, the room I'm sitting in has quite a few windows with the lightning going on right now. It's been, it was a nice setting for a spooky story tonight.
Yeah. Thank you, Geraldine.
Okay, jealous. I don't know how she comes, she gets lightning and the rest of us don't. I mean, how does this work?
Just come to, you could make your way to Cincinnati right now. There's plenty of it to share.
Thank you for the offer.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining in the call. Dave, is there any final comment you have?
I mean, this is kind of my genre of stories, is I call them the Twilight Zone type stories. And, you know, they can be, frankly, I had not thought about using them in a business type setting, but thinking about the rats and having worked at three different large corporate organizations, there's plenty of rats, and sometimes you claw your way out of them, and sometimes you decide their rats are in control and you better go somewhere else kind of thing. So, yeah, it was an interesting use of those types of stories.
Yeah, and I think it allows a certain safe zone when you can talk about the story. It doesn't have to be directed at the company itself. You know, you can make that leap, as my questions have, but there's a certain safety in making the insights be about the story. And because it's very hard to say, you know, the sales staff over on the other department has got a bunch of rats in it and it's making me crazy or stealing my work.
Interesting. Yeah. Nice job on telling the stories.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to hearing some of your Twilight tales.
I'll pop you one in the email that I just finished doing.
Okay.
And these are not typically for children type things. I don't mean to be that way, but like most of us that do these things, I frankly have no idea the ending of a story when I start one, and sometimes the wife goes, "You're really much stranger than I thought you were."
Okay. Yeah, and then, Dave, if you want to get the other stories, there's that link. You could go on my website, and just right there on the homepage is the sign-up form for them.
Happy to.
Good. And if anybody else is just listening to the recording, that's spacepainter.com, spacepainter, one word, .com, and you go there and sign up for the ghost stories. Thanks, everybody, and have a great night. I think we're not going to have a leadership meeting tonight because Tricia and Mark weren't able to be on the call. But thanks for joining, everybody, and have a great night.
Don't forget to stop.
Thank you, Tom. That was excellent. I mean, it's a whole other avenue to walk down, and I appreciate you opening that door.
Thank you. And what did you say, Pete?
Oh, don't forget to stop recording.
Right.
And Pete, don't forget to stay warm up there.
Yeah.
Keep warm.
See you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.